Welcome to All Together Now. This is Eleanor LaCane. One of the great changes of the past century has been the progress towards women's equality. In the past 100 years, women have won the right to vote, the right to own property, the right to keep wages we earn, the right to choose when to have children. Women running for and holding elected office is now an accepted part of our life. Yet women are now facing headwinds that threaten to block further progress, in fact, even roll back hard-earned rights. The number of women in elective office has stalled at about 18% in Congress and about 24% in state houses around the country. A well-funded attack from conservatives is threatening the rights of women. Our guest today is right in the middle of these battles. Ellie Boldman Hill is an attorney, a state legislator, and a mother from Missoula, Montana. Representative Hill is in her third term as a member of the Montana House of Representatives. Time magazine named her as one of the 40 under 40 political rising stars in the country. Ellie's been voted Missoula's best activist for 9 consecutive years. In 2013, she received the Hero Award for her legislative advocacy from the Montana chapter of the National Alliance on Mental Illness. She is passionate about issues affecting women and young people and serves as the state director of WILL, the Women Legislators Lobby, and Western Regional Representative for the National Council of State Legislatures. She and her husband have 3 sons, aged 10, 6, and 21 months. Representative Ellie Boldman Hill, welcome to All Together Now.
Hi, Eleanor.
Hey, nice to hear you online here.
Well, thank you for having me.
Yeah, well, I'm so excited about our conversation today because there's so many battles happening, and you're right in the middle of all of them.
That's right. Yep. I like to say, that what happens at the state legislatures are the cheapest state in town. So that's sort of where we're seeing all the attacks now.
Right, and it's hard for us to reach our federal representative sometimes. So the people in the state are people we actually can see and talk to and touch.
That's right.
So you're a third-term state legislator now in Montana. Do you think there is a war on women, and how is that showing up in Montana?
Oh, absolutely. So everything we see at the national level is the microcosms exist now in all 50 states, in large part thanks to the coordination of ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council. In my 3 terms, each term has been a succession of more coordinated right-wing bills that are just templates, right? They're just identical in all 50 states, and of course include the wedge issues like choice. And so all of the same ones are there in all 50 states, but certainly we see them on the front lines in Montana. I'm trying to think of examples. Taking away birth control pills, the access to birth control clinics, the Planned Parenthood attacks, they're all coordinated and they exist just straight from ALEC. So, yeah, we see them on the front lines for sure.
So how do the people of Montana respond to that? Are people aware that ALEC is kind of a front for the big money right-wing conservative interests, or do people think this is what we want to do in our state, or is it 50-50,
yeah,
or what's happening there?
I think the state of Montana reflects, the rest of the country, that a lot of people feel that Roe v. Wade, was decided, for example, before I was born. So it's sort of established law. And, I think Montanans have a little bit of a libertarian bent to them. They don't like the government telling them what to do, and that comes with equality and LGBT issues, but certainly with choice. And I think that for the most part, moderates and certainly the progressives in the left don't appreciate politicians telling them what to do. And so that includes politicians in their doctor's offices. And so in large part, most of the particularly anti-choice legislation, we're often able to kill it in the state house without it going to the governor's desk. In the state of Montana, we happen to have a Democratic governor, Governor Steve Bullock, and so it would be vetoed most likely anyway. But for the most part, we are able to stop it with generational differences of moderate Republicans now who, like I said, see Roe v. Wade as the established law of the land. But that doesn't take away the rhetoric and the comparing women to cattle, which I've heard on the House floor.
Compare women to cattle?
Yeah. They had a bill, I think it was related to mandatory ultrasounds, I think, I think that was the one where Republican legislators compared women to cattle. Yeah, that's happened in other states as well. But like I said, we're mostly able to kill that stuff on the floor. But it doesn't just stop there. You know, it's sort of like the rhetoric of being pro-life, but yet they don't fund or vote to fund any of the services for the actual living children in our state, which is the irony of it all. We did have a bill last session that I thought was one of the more offensive one, and that was to drug test people that get what's called TANF, which we think of as food stamps. That ultimately was defeated in the Senate, but it passed wildly in the House, which is where I serve. And these are ALEC ideas, right? They're in all 50 states. In fact, they did pass that law in Utah and in Florida. I think one of the district courts over there overturned it in Florida as not being constitutional. But these are what we see now pretty often, is the attack on women and attack on the poor.
Yeah, and you know, you're highlighting here some of the key problems and complexities within the right-wing attack. That here we have the right-wing, that Republicans generally have been about wanting to have limited government, and they don't want government telling them what to do, except that they're the ones that are really pushing for government to take a very active role in the bedroom and with women's bodies and doing this mandatory ultrasound and all of these things. It's like, do they ever stop and think how self-contradictory they are and what they say versus what they do?
Oh, yeah, no, I try to, whenever I can, sort of, you know, bang my shoe on the table type and point out the irony of it all, right? That they,
right.
We had a bill last session that the session before, they passed a bill in Montana, like they do in a lot of states, to expand telemedicine. And particularly in a state like Montana, that's great for rural areas and rural doctors and rural hospitals. And it had large bipartisan support. And so then last session, they came back with another creative way to put a politician in a woman's healthcare clinic by saying that telemedicine could not be used on abortion services, which it's not used on abortion services. It's just a creative way to monkey with women's rights. So I tried to amend the bill to include that telemedicine also couldn't be used in vasectomies, which it also isn't in Montana. But, you know, we just have to fight back in creative ways. And then that's the irony of it all, right? It's they want to be in our doctor's offices and tell women how to, have their own health care. And then they want to be in the bedrooms, apparently, of everyone in the state. And, it was a felony, like you could go to prison in the state of Montana until last session if you were gay in the state of Montana. The United States Supreme Court, the Montana Supreme Court had both said that was unconstitutional. In fact, it was a Scalia opinion, and the Montana Prosecuting Attorneys Association said that in all 56 counties that there was not one county attorney that would enforce the law, and yet session after session they refused to take the law off the books. For what reason, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, it's sad and it's offensive, and there's openly gay members, my colleagues in the Montana legislature, and they had to hear that, right? They had to hear that they were felons. Finally, last session, we were able to get it off the books. And then, you know, and during the time we were there, of course, the United States Supreme Court gave them the equality that they deserved. So, that to me is in my 6 years in office, that has been the quickest I've seen a change in policy in this country, and that's with gay rights. It's just been amazing.
Yeah, that's been a phenomenal movement towards expansion of human rights, and I was just so thrilled. I was actually, by the way, down at the Supreme Court the day they handed down the decision saying that gay marriage is legal all across the country. It's like, what a wonderful moment to be an American and to celebrate that advancement of human rights.
Yeah, no, it was totally exciting. But I think the direction we're going to see, though, right, is going to be this, and we saw this bill in the Montana legislature last session, which is this new right to discriminate based on religious conviction, right? And so that's sort of the idea of the, you know, the guy that makes your wedding cake doesn't want to have to give it to a gay couple, right? So I think we're going to see more and more of that, this sort of idea of the right to discriminate being a constitutional right, and that will be the new talking point, I think, to force bigoted views onto, you know, our communities and our friends and our colleagues and our family members. So we saw that bill in the Montana legislature last session. Of course, they had it on the floor when we were debating it. It was also on the governor's desk in Indiana. And at the time, that number one trending hashtag on Twitter was Boycott Indiana. So certainly, people, you know, Main Street Americans can fight back on their own, and they don't appreciate that.
Right, exactly. Well, you mentioned this ALEC group, and for our listeners who may not be familiar with it, you know, we have a sense of the right wing being very well funded, very well organized. Can you describe for our listeners what ALEC is, and then how you, as a state legislator, you know, run up against them?
Yes. Yeah, so, to me, this is—I mean, I'm so glad you asked this question, because every American needs to know what is happening in government, and particularly state government, because as I mentioned, it's the cheapest state in town. You don't have to buy, a congressional seat or a United States Senate seat in anymore. And by the way, with Citizens United, that's going to be largely possible. But, now ALEC is mobilized, basically corporations. So like the Koch brothers, the NRA is a big ALEC contributor, so the National Rifle Association, the Koch brothers, oil and gas companies, and that's sort of the environmental front, right? And so all these big, and oh, by the way, international companies too, right? These aren't just American companies. You sort of think of it like they're all in a room with their big cigars, and they decide what model legislation that they want passed. And so the NRA, of course, says, well, you know, we want guns in schools. Literally, we had two bills last session in the Montana legislature, just like you had in all the other states, to allow guns on college campuses, right? That's passed in some states. We were able to defeat it in Montana. But, you know, guns in schools, guns in bars, guns in banks, I'm not even kidding. And then to oppose efforts for sensible background checks, right, to keep guns out of the hands of dangerous individuals. And so that's the NRA, right, or environmental bills, or most notably in Wisconsin, right-to-work bills, right, to defeat unions and labor and livable wages and defeat paid leave bills, right, or women, I don't know, maybe getting paid the same amount that men do. So
what a radical idea.
Yeah, so ALEC is all in a room, and they come up with their model legislation every year, and then they pay, and this is totally true, they pay little old legislators like me, right, just mom-and-pop legislators around this country, conservative lawmakers, generally very right-wing conservative lawmakers, they pay them to go to ALEC conferences throughout the country, and these are lovely events, right, held at lovely hotels where everything is paid for, including your travel, your trip, your stay. Babysitters are paid, ironically, because they don't help subsidize daycare elsewhere. But anyway, legislators are hosted. They're hosted to model legislation. And so then these templates,
wait a minute. So you say they'll pay the legislator to go? Like, how much would they pay you to go if you agreed to go?
Well, so they don't pay like your salary, but they're paying for you to be there, right? Like, they're paying your hotel, they're paying your flight, they're paying
for
your
food. So it's all expenses paid in this lovely hotel, kind of like a vacation.
Yeah. Like a vacation in the form of a conference, right? And then the conference is, they're given these model legislations, and then that's why now you see these coordinated efforts all over the land, right? These are, these aren't like bill ideas that came from, you know, your constituents back in Billings, Montana. No, these are made by these corporate guys that sat in a room and said, these are what we want to see in all 50 states, and this is how they're accomplishing it, right? That's why you see the same right to discriminate bill in 13 states, or the same sort of anti-immigration bills in Arizona and in Florida. And why do they all look exactly the same, right? It's because they're ALEC legislation. And ALEC sort of serves as this expert, right? Because they have all these really smart people that put these bills together. And then ALEC is in your state to help with their staff, to help support the legislation through. So lobbying it through, right? It's the most really dangerous thing that I have seen come and grow and now be a force in the Montana legislature, in the Arizona legislature, in the New York Assembly. I mean, it's real. They're ALEC bills, and we try to call the right wing legislators out. We try to say, you know, I'm looking at the words of this bill, Senator so-and-so, and boy, this sure looks exactly like four other bills. And they'll end up saying no.
This looks familiar.
Yeah, well, but the bottom line is this isn't homegrown laws, right? This is corporations that are coming into your local state houses. And now, of course, they have burgeoning local government ALEC conferences. So they'll be, you know, ALEC bills at your school board. And I know I probably sound like this conspiracy theory, but I've served now for 3 terms, and I've seen the brown bag ALEC lunches in the Montana Capitol with all the same right-wing legislators sitting in the room eating ALEC lunches, right? I mean, it's real. It's real. And these bills are real, and we're going to see them every time.
Yeah, this is really scary what you're talking about, because it's basically, you know, it's using the legislative process and kind of giving it the fig leaf of it. This is what the constituents want. But it's really very much a top-down agenda by the far right to push their program into all the states.
Yeah, no, so it's totally real, right? This is why we have now, for example, private prisons, right? Because the private prison guys, right, the big corporation that makes money off of profiting off of our criminal justice system, basically, they go to ALEC, and then you have private prison bills all over the country. I mean, they're using us. They're using us, and people need to know that this is a nefarious, scary thing, right? ALEC is scary, and people need to know what it is, and it's real. And that's the real thing on the state front. Those are all those bills.
Right, and that's ALEC, A-L-E-C.
Yeah, the American Legislative Exchange Council. People should look it up. And that's another thing of where all these voting rights bills are coming from, right? Like, these trying to take, like what like mom and pop back in your home state says, hey, you know, I think we should make it harder to vote. You know,
right.
I don't care what state you're from. It doesn't seem like it's a pressing issue, right? And then you'll hear like, that there's a lot of corruption in the voting process, that somehow people are, you know, voting twice, or and you'll have these little old gray-haired county clerks saying, yeah, no, we have a pretty good system, right? Like, there's not these corrupt county clerks out there, you know. It doesn't exist, but yet we have bills every session in the most creative ways you can imagine to make it harder to vote in this country. And that's why now you're seeing the federal lawsuits down in the South and the different things that are occurring, where people are saying, you know, this isn't right. Now, you tell me why, unless, you know, these same bills are happening all over the country, ALEC bills to make it harder to vote. They're the same exact legislation, and they're passing in some states. And why do you want less people to vote? Because, you know, as we know, when more people vote, when more single moms and people of color and when they more and young people, when more people vote, Democrats tend to win. And it's just the facts, right? That's why we do voter turnout. And so, like, this is real. This is not a conspiracy theory. This is real. That's where these bills all come from. The NRA, that's real. They are pushing legislation through the state legislative process to, you know, that are killing Americans, that are dangerous to Americans. Why? So they can sell more guns, right? It's crazy. It is dangerous, and we have to find a way to fight back. And, you know, through a variety of ways, I hope that we're able to do that. But
yeah. Well, what do we have on kind of the liberal left, progressive side? There used to be the Center for Policy Alternatives, which would be kind of
sure. A
progressive companion, but I think they couldn't get funding and went out of business. Do we have kind of a progressive alternative mm-hmm. to ALEC?
Yeah, so right now, I just actually got back from a conference. Well, I'm still out here, but in D.C., what's called the State Innovation Exchange. And that was a combination of, I think, the Center for American Progress, a whole bunch of different organizations got together to try to, you know, fight back, to try to organize legislators. Now, they, you know, don't have the same kind of money that the Koch brothers do, but to try to galvanize resources to educate legislators around the country on progressive legislation, right? On how to, one, fight back against ALEC bills. I mean, like half of the conference was, you know, just trying to play defense against ALEC bills, but also to try to move progressive legislative forward. And let's face it, we have, you know, we have a great front man. We have, you know, Barack Obama as the President of the United States. That's a great cheerleader for us on a lot of these when you can't get anything done in Congress. And in fact, as you heard, our president, you know, for example, on gun control, is saying, like, if Congress doesn't have the will, then the state legislatures can do it there, right? So we're hoping that that's the way to do it and to get good progressive policy around things that are the values we care about. And that's called the State Innovation Exchange.
State Innovation Exchange. And for our
yeah.
listeners who might want to support that, how would they get in touch? Where is that based?
I'm trying to think. I think it might be out of the University of Wisconsin in Madison, but it was the merge of the Progressive States Network and the Center for State Innovation and ALICE. It was a whole bunch of organizations that got together. But you could Google the State Innovation Exchange. Sometimes people call it SIX, right? SIX versus ALEC, which is, you know, our nemesis. So, yeah, that's one great way to support that or to just check us out. There was about 250 legislators from all 50 states that came to the conference. They invited us to the White House. We got the mayor of New York, de Blasio, came and talked to us about, you know, his progressive leanings. So, you know, it's a really good way to follow, you know, if you're a progressive like me, to follow how we play defense, how we fight back, and how we try to move our agenda forward.
Yeah, so that's encouraging. So there is a progressive version, and you know, you're not out there kind of trying to twisting in the wind, fighting one at a time when there's this big mammoth ALEC conservative push to dominate the state agenda. So that's fantastic that the State Innovation Exchange is there and that you're involved with it. And you know, the thing is, when you talk to the people, usually, on the whole, most of the progressive agenda is supported by most of the people, and that's why they, as you say, they have to prevent people from voting, because
right.
if more people voted, we would have a more liberal progressive program advanced in the country. So
that's exactly right.
They can't win on the merits, so they just try to keep us from voting.
So
what do you say? Right. You know, a lot of people have given up on electoral politics, given up on voting and government, and they say, well, my vote doesn't matter at all. What do you say to those people?
No, my gosh, no, that's crazy. Because all politics is local, right? It matters. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's why I care so deeply about local and state politics. I mean, I do care, of course, about our federal government, but the bottom line is, what affects your everyday life is happens at the state level. In the state of Montana, we're you know, as large as all of the entire Northeast, but we only have 1 million people, right? We have 1 million people in the whole state of Montana. We have one congressional seat. I mean, we don't make a lot of noise, but for that 1 million people, for example, our ability to find barely enough bipartisan support to pass Medicaid expansion in our state last session, for our 1 million people, that would affect 70,000 of them. So, yeah, people should give a damn about who they elect to state office, because not all Republicans are created equal. And, you know, certainly neither are Democrats. But I think the Republicans that, you know, my mom and dad voted for back in the day are not sometimes the same Republicans that they're electing now. These Republicans are sort of this Liberty Caucus idea, or you could call them the Tea Party or whatever you want, but they are not, you know, if John McCain is too liberal for Yavapai County or whatever in Arizona, this is what I'm talking about. I mean, these Republicans now at the state level are people that really want to dismantle government. They do not vote to fund any common sense programs. It's sad. And of course, certainly wouldn't have voted to pass Medicaid expansion or Obamacare, as they call it. But it would affect 70,000 people in their state. It would save people's lives. And ultimately, common sense prevails and the right thing prevails. And so, you know, I hope folks will pay attention to that, because that matters very deeply in Montana to 70,000 people, and to people all over the country it matters. And not just to health care for people, but, you know, as I mentioned, the fundamental right to vote. That's shocking to me. It's shocking to me that we would want to make it more difficult for American citizens to vote. And people should fight back, and they should know, you know, care about your state and local government, care about who is your legislator, what district you live in, and who they are, and then fight like hell to make sure that one that reflects your values wins, because it really makes such a difference to people.
Yeah, that's so well said. And, you know, it's so interesting to me, people who are on the edges or not really involved in government don't see that these battles are happening every day, and that one vote can decide who gets elected and who doesn't. One vote in the legislature, like with you in the Montana House, sometimes legislation will pass or fail based on one person who's there, or one person who's in there could, you know, change the way people think about it.
And in fact, I will share that during my 2013 session, Medicaid expansion failed by one vote in the Montana legislature.
There you go.
And then 2 years later, it passed barely. And I will tell you why people should care. So, for example, when I was in the last session, during the session, the very end, when it was the sort of waning days of the fight for Medicaid expansion, we found out that my husband was diagnosed with stage 3 testicular cancer. And through that, I learned that, and my husband's 37 years old, but a man that's 37 years old who is diagnosed at the same stage that my husband was in, who is uninsured, is four times more likely to die, right? So
oh my goodness.
Whether or not somebody has health insurance is truly, right, truly a life and death thing, right? So, and to know that it was by one vote, the session before, how many people were affected during the 2 years, right, that we didn't pass Medicaid expansion in Montana? And in other states, you know, haven't been able to pass it. So all of this and caring about who you elect, and whether or not, for example, people have access to Planned Parenthood clinics, to receive health screening, cervical exams, breast cancer exams, that the rhetoric around closing those clinics, you know, not one federal dollar goes to abortion services. It's against the law. Planned Parenthood said that forever. And yet that rhetoric continues. Planned Parenthood clinics close, and people don't have access to health care. It's, you know, it's shocking. And so people need to care deeply about who they elect at the state level. And, you know, yeah, I know that the federal races are fun. I'm certainly following the Bernie, Hillary, possibly Joe Biden. I've been following that as well. But you know, I think that the date that they should follow is the state legislatures. That's where your ticket is.
Right, and, you know, we can have so much influence at the state legislative level. And, you know, you it may feel kind of remote when you talk about a member of Congress or president is, you know, way out there. But, you know, your state, and, of course, I encourage everybody to be involved and vote on those also. But at your state legislative level, you know, you can really make a huge difference in people's lives. How is your husband now, by the way? Is he okay?
Well, thank you. Yeah, for asking. So we went through intensive chemo, and then he went out to the Virginia Mason Cancer Institute in Seattle and had some surgery. So now we do the whole CT scans and continue to, you know, continue to sort of wait. I mean, I can't tell you enough how much you know, it's changed my vision of healthcare in this country, how, you know, expensive it is. I mean, I know that just sounds like a simple thing to say, but and how much it's affected other things, right? So I have another understanding of disability claims and paid leave for family members and caregivers when my husband was going through chemotherapy. You know, mm-hmm. I was able to go back to work right away. And, you know, it's just a fascinating thing. Children, for example, our three boys lit the torch at our cancer relay for life. And, you know, it's just now to watch what my husband went through with chemotherapy. He has what's called a port. I'm sure some of your listeners know what those are. And to watch him get repoked every time. And then I think about, you know, children that go through that. It's just amazing. And then to, you know, elect people that will deny people fundamental things like health care coverage. It just, you know, it's sad to me. And then, you know, when I mentioned we had a bill, I don't know if I mentioned this yet, to drug test poor people receiving food stamps. Well, you know, the vast majority of folks that receive food stamps, or TANF as we call them now, temporary aid to needy families, are kids, right? Like, that's who benefits from mom and dad getting food stamps, right? And the very idea, I tried to introduce an amendment on that where we can drug test legislators. And anyone that receives in Montana, heck, a lot of right-wingers receive what are called ag subsidies for their big old ranches. You know, why don't they get drug tested? So, I mean, the whole thing's offensive, right, that we would drug test poor people. And, I hope people will pay attention. I know that the state races they seem like they're always happening and always the signs out in the yards, but it just matters so much to the lives of your neighbors, your friends, your family, you.
Yeah, it totally does matter. And, you know, so many in your generation in particular have given up on politics and government. Why did you decide to run for office?
Oh, my goodness. well, I grew up I grew up in a union family. My dad worked for the telephone company, what was called Mountain Bell out in the West. And he actually took one night class a semester for 26 years and graduated from college with me. So that's sort of like my proud thing. So, you know, so we talked about politics in the house. And when I graduated from law school, I worked as a prosecutor, actually, down in Boise, Idaho. And, I just saw two things that, and that was sort of generational poverty. I worked out at what we called juvie. and a lot of the folks that were in juvenile detention, you know, parents were brought in orange suits because they were in and out of jail and prisons themselves. And so this sort of idea of generational poverty. But then the other big part of the criminal justice system that I saw firsthand was mental illness and substance abuse. So they call that co-occurring disorders. And, you know, just this idea that we were having an entire criminal justice system of poor people and sick people, it just changed my perspective. And so I decided that I wanted to do something different, and I applied for a job to be the executive director of the state of Montana's largest homeless shelter and soup kitchen. That brought me out to Missoula, and it had three facilities in downtown Missoula, you know, classic soup kitchen and homeless shelter and a women's and kids shelter, and then we had a Department of Veterans Affairs, VA, veterans shelter, because of course veterans, and I hope most Americans know, veterans make up a huge percent of our homeless population, somewhere in the amount of a fourth in some areas. Mm-hmm. And so that's, you know, that's the cost of war, right? That they come back and
one of the many costs of war.
That's right. And so through my experience then advocating you know, another set of poverty issues, I decided that I had enough, and then I'd run for office myself.
Well, I'm so happy you did.
Well, thank you for saying that. Yeah, I always sort of joke that, you know, it's kids and homeless folks, and they don't generally have a lobbyist, right? So, like the NRA and oil and gas companies. So, we just do our best to try to, you know, show awareness and shine a light on social justice in this country. And so, I've been there, and now I'm pretty hard to beat. So I hope to be there.
I'm sure you are. I'd love to go out there and vote for you in Missoula, Montana.
Well, home of the Grizz. Go Grizz. And, you know, we're the home. Missoula is the Brad Pitt movie, River Runs Through It. A river really does run right through it. And, everyone should come out to Missoula. It's a great place.
Yeah. And, you know, listening to your story reminds me somewhat of Elizabeth Warren, the U.S. Senator from Massachusetts, whose campaign I worked on. And Senator Warren actually started out as a Republican And she was studying. People don't know this story. I don't know why she doesn't tell it more. I think she'd get even more support than she already does. She was a Republican from Oklahoma, and she was studying bankruptcy law, and she thought that people were declaring bankruptcy to get out of paying their bills. So they'd go and buy a 52-inch TV screen or a car or whatever and then declare bankruptcy. So she was like, you know, I'm going to go down there and see what's going on and see if I can put a stop to this misuse of the bankruptcy law. But what she found when she went in to the sessions and was listening to story after story and examining the cases, she found that the major reason most people were declaring bankruptcy was because they had an illness and they had to stop work because they were sick and couldn't work, and then they didn't have money to pay because they didn't have health care, so they quickly went bankrupt trying to pay for their medical care without an income coming in. And that was, you know, the single biggest reason people were going bankrupt. And she completely changed her tune, and she saw, you know, good, decent people, hardworking, who either through an illness or loss of a job or some combination ended up broke and unable to meet their bills. So that's what turned her around, and she started saying, we have to deal with the bankruptcy law here and make it so help people get back on their feet. And she saw the big banks getting the big breaks, and then the little people kind of getting screwed at the bottom. So that was her story. So I'm hearing you going, you know, from prosecutor into the generational poverty, wanting to deal with that, and then the homeless shelter and soup kitchens all the way into let's make the laws and let's go upstream here and deal with the, the problems at the head.
Well, I'm glad you told me that, because, of course, Elizabeth Warren is, you know, one of the people I want to be when I grow up. You know,
don't we all?
She's my you know, one of my heroes, and I just think the whole world of her. And, you know, maybe another time we can get her to run for president. But I appreciate you speaking the truth about medical bankruptcy, because, again, that has been so persuasive, I think, to, you know, some of the folks on the other side of the aisle of me, some of the moderate Republicans. That idea of uncompensated care to rural hospitals and local hospitals and big hospitals, uncompensated care, folks that aren't able to pay their bills, you know, it affects us all. And ultimately, you know, that was how we were able to push Medicaid expansion over the line to pass was exactly what you just said, is the common sense of what you said and what Elizabeth Warren recognized as, you know, folks that have health care then, you know, get their bills paid. But I sure hope she'll keep speaking up to Wall Street. You know, that's one of our favorite topics. I love our senator from Montana, U.S. Senator John Tester. He's our organic farmer with seven fingers and a flat top out there. And we like seeing him in D.C. He talks truth to power a lot, too. But, you know, I think that's what's interesting about folks, you know, folks like my parents who watch Fox News and believe some of the rhetoric is, you know, it's astounding to me that they'll vote against their own interests, you know, but we just have to make sure that radio programs like yours and people are spreading the true message of what's really going out there. And that's, you know, clearly what Elizabeth Warren does best.
Right. Well, and you do it so well, too. And we know, you know, none of us can do it alone, too. So you're so smart to be connecting with other legislators. And in fact, you and I met earlier this week at the Women's Legislative Lobby, a conference happening here in Washington, D.C. And you're a state leader for the Women Legislative Lobby. Will, can you explain for our audience what Will is and why you're involved and what happened at the conference this week?
Yeah, you know, so I kind of got involved with Will Wand through, you know, well, being a woman legislator, right? Like,
right, it's the place to be.
And Will Wand is that, right? It's the Women Legislators Lobby, and so they get women legislators of all ages. In fact, my roommate, Roberta Beavers from Maine, was probably in her late 60s, I would imagine, and there was wonderful women from all around the country. I think all 50 states were represented at the conference, and women legislators from all 50 states. Now, of course, we're represented at the conference. Well, we're still not represented in an equitable way at the state legislatures, or, of course, in Congress, you know, But we're getting there. But it's not enough, and so that's why organizations like Will Wand exist, to teach women legislators how to be better legislators, how to increase their power to pass legislation. There was a topics on how to run for higher office. So when I want to become Elizabeth Ford. So there were those topics, but. But the other thing that Will Wand does is really focus on how to increase our role and our voices as state legislators at the federal level. And so they teach you how to, take your constituent base and make sure their voices are heard at the federal level. And so we had meetings all day on Tuesday with our entire congressional delegation. So we walked around with the U.S. senators and the Congress people that maybe we didn't vote for. and the main topic that Will Wand wanted us to focus on was, for example, on the Iran deal and spending money on our wars and trying to really shine a light on the high cost of war, the high cost of the military machine, and trying to, as women, good women legislators, to make sure that they know that we would like that money spent elsewhere and for things that that matter, moms and pops and kids back home. And so that's sort of the cost of war argument that I was getting in. But, that's what Will Wand does, and it was wonderful. It's wonderful to be around other empowered women of all ages. And I kind of came about then through Debbie Walsh and the Center for American Women in Politics, which is out of Rutgers University. They're a bipartisan organization that really also sort of shines a light on the idea of women in elected office, trying to get women leaders, and not just in political leaders, but in the boardroom, in the courtroom, and every way they can empower women to be at the table. Because, the whole saying is that if you're not at the table, then you're on the menu. that's what that's about, Will Wand, and it's great, and I was happy to be a part of it, and I certainly was happy to meet you.
Yeah, it was a great pleasure to meet you and to be there, and I don't know if I mentioned to you that the whole idea of Will came out of one. I was a board member for the originating group for about 20 years, and in the middle of it, I said, our main thing is trying to reduce military spending and shift it
right.
to meet needs at home, like education and the environment and equal pay and so forth. And it was clear we were not winning after years of trying to do this, so I said, ladies, let's reevaluate our strategy. Doing more of the same is not going to work, so we need to do something differently. So we actually set up a strategic planning group, which I led, and
wow.
I kind of drew this map on the wall, and I said, okay, well, here's our individual voters and members of our group one, Women's Action for New Directions. So we have them, and then we're trying to influence Congress, and drew a circle for members of Congress. It's like, well, who do members of Congress listen to? They listen to their spouses, they listen to their funders, and they listen to their constituents, or at least the voters who show up. And if you're not a voting constituent, you're less likely to be heard, even if you're in the district. So that's when I drew it out. I was like, who is a good constituent that the members of Congress are more likely to listen to? And that's when I said, well, the state legislators, because each state legislator represents not just their own vote, but tens of thousands of voters.
That's right, yeah.
So it's a tremendously powerful group in terms of trying to talk sense and having a good budget with sensible budget priorities there on Capitol Hill. So I'm still hopeful at some point that will happen. But meanwhile, we've got lots of battles going on at the state level, and I'm so happy you're right in the middle of it. And speaking of battles, we had another, massive, gunning down of innocent people in a college, community college, Washington State last week. And it seems like these are happening with increased frequency and intensity. What's happening with guns in Montana? I might think of it as kind of a Western state and everyone tooting their gun and there's no prayer of common sense gun controls, but how strong is the NRA in your state, and
yes,
what are the prospects for gun control there?
Well, I appreciate you asking this because, you know, I'm an attorney, I'm a mom, and I come from a state where, you know, both Democrats and Republicans all own guns. You know, we're proud of our Second Amendment heritage in the great state of Montana. In fact, Montana has more people with hunting licenses per capita than anywhere in the nation. And so we certainly want common sense policy when it comes to gun control, but that isn't to say that we haven't, you know, as a people in Montana, just like the rest of this nation, you know, said enough is enough, that this is an out of control epidemic. It's scary, it's dangerous. And I not to shift back into Alec, but these laws that we're seeing right now haven't just been gun control measures. They have been Alec laws to expand gun rights, right? So I'll give you an example.
Oh my God, no.
That have passed, right? They passed. They passed in Montana. They passed, and that includes stand your ground laws, right? Expanding self defense laws. Those are all ALEC laws.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the first ALEC laws in Florida, in Montana, it all over. I think 36 states. The exact year that the Trayvon Martin stand your ground law was expanded in Florida, they passed in 36 states. Okay, those are ALEC template laws, right? To expand gun ownership and gun laws. We had, maybe 8-9 bills last session in the Montana legislature that, again, are identical in some way all over the country and in your own state legislators to expand gun rights, right? And I mentioned earlier to put guns in more places, right? Guns in schools and banks and bars, guns in hospital rooms. So, for example, laws so that an ER doc can't ask whether you have a weapon or not. You know what I mean? It's crazy. And so the very idea that we're, you know, also now trying to, as a nation, put common sense gun control laws in, right, to keep guns out of the hands of dangerous people, that's one battle. It's another battle to just to stop the craziness, you know, that they're trying to push down our throats in the other way, right, to put guns in more places. And again, yeah. this is the NRA, right? This is what they do to sell more weapons and to, you know, control the narrative, because it's such a wedge issue that Obama's going to take all our guns or something, because we don't think, you know, people that have been adjudicated mentally ill. And as a prosecutor, I did what are called mental commitments, right? A mental commitment is if somebody by law, right, in the statute, is such a danger to themselves or a danger to others that they're committed, right? They're committed in the state of Montana to what we call it our Warm Springs Mental Hospital. And so the state, right, a judge, looked at the evidence and said, yeah, they're a danger to themselves or others. Well, that's called adjudicated mentally ill. And in the state of Montana and a lot of other states, they don't report their adjudicated mentally ill to the national background check system. So even if you did a background check, and remember at gun shows and a myriad of other places that you can buy semi-automatic weapons, they don't even do background checks. But even in the event that you went into your local sporting goods store and you did a background check, it wouldn't even turn up if you were mentally ill, because your state, you know, in some states isn't reporting them. In Montana, we don't comply with the federal law to do that. And a few years ago, a young man, I think with 6 or 9 days after he got out of Warm Springs Mental Hospital, went into one of our Ace Hardwares in Miles City, Montana, in eastern Montana, and shot a young woman who was the valedictorian of Miles City High School that he knew from high school. And he, you know, certainly Ace Hardware did a background check, and he had just been released from Warm Springs Mental Hospital. So this is all real, right? This uh-huh. is real. And to know that there are conservative lawmakers that object to us, you know, doing background checks on folks that are a danger to themselves or a danger to other people or are domestic abusers. It should make people angry. And
yeah.
Well,
I think part of how we're going to win on the gun issue is, I think, a shift in focus to look at the companies that are making literally billions of dollars off of these guns, and to expose that a lot of what they're doing is about them making money. And they don't care if the women are gunned down, if the children are gunned down in Sandy Hook. As long as they're selling their weapons and making their billions, they're happy. And I think that's got to be exposed.
Yeah, you know, you sound exactly like that's why you worked with Elizabeth Warren. That's what she does well, right? She calls them out for the truth of what it is, right? This isn't really about the Second Amendment at all and a well-regulated militia at all, right? This is about corporate people that make money off of selling, you know, as many guns to as many people as possible. And they're creative about it, right? Like in Montana, for example, I mentioned that we have more hunting license per capita than anywhere in the country. Well, they had a bill last session to lower the hunting age, right? So that, you know, 8-year-olds can go hunt. Well, in Montana, we didn't have a problem with our hunting laws, right? Like, you know, we think maybe you should be 12 to hunt, right? To shoot. You know, Dick Cheney wasn't able to do it. But anyway, I think I think it's going to be grassroots activism, honestly. I think that this whole sort of moms demand action, mayors demand action, this sort of moms and everyday people demanding outrage, demanding change. I just saw yesterday that People Magazine, right, the sort of the glossy rag that, you know, is about movie stars and the Kardashians. People Magazine dedicated a two-page spread in this week's issue. People should go check it out. I haven't seen it yet, but I saw online that they published the 535 congressional phone numbers and asked their readers to contact them about asking for common sense gun reform. So, I mean, it's fascinating that I hope that this is a movement where people say, you know, this is enough. And I have seen good folks on the other side of the aisles not be intimidated by the NRA. I mean, I'm certainly not intimidated by the NRA. But you know, a lot of folks in a lot of areas are starting to see the NRA for what it is. That, you know, it isn't the NRA that it was 20 years ago. This is a political machine for special interests making money, and they're doing it at the, you know, with kids dying. So I hope we just see some change, and we see it quick. It sure seems like everyone's talking about it.
Right, that would be great. I'm so happier they are carrying that perspective and vote into that battle. You know, another thing that's really underlying all of this is the influence of big money in politics. And we're seeing that big time now in the presidential race, but it's really affecting even state races now. Talk a little bit about how you see the influence of big money playing out, and particularly the unique role that Montana has in the fight against Citizen United.
Yeah, so this is the area that I guess that I'm more passionate about than any other area of politics, and unfortunately, in some ways, maybe it's perhaps not that sexy to people, but the Supreme Court case, Citizens United, and accompanying decisions that have changed the ability to control campaign spending, right? It is devastating, not just, of course, at the federal level, but at the state level. I mean, when I say that you can buy a seat, and certainly a state legislative seat is, like I said, it's the cheapest state in town. You can, the Wilkes brothers, who are sort of like the Koch brothers, they gave the maximum husband and wife contribution in the state of Montana to every single Republican that ran, right? So, and they don't, you know, they don't live in Montana. So it's just, you know, the fascinating role that money is going to have in politics is now unfettered, right, with the Citizens United decision. And so Montana has a unique history because 100 years ago, or maybe a little bit more than 100 years ago, we are best known for the Copper Kings, right? And one of the Copper Kings out there in Montana literally was prosecuted because he bought a United States Senate seat. He literally purchased it, purchased the votes for it, and was convicted for that. And so through that, Montana had some of the toughest campaign finance laws in the country. You know, Montanans in all 56 counties, you know, don't believe their elections are for sale. They don't like big out-of-state corporations buying our politics. And for a long time, this wasn't a partisan issue. For over 100 years, it wasn't a partisan issue until the Citizens United case. And so our then Attorney General, Steve Bullock, who is now our governor, actually took our case to the United States Supreme Court in trying to defend our 100-year-old campaign finance laws. And, of course, because of the precedent of Citizen United, our arguments fell on deaf ears with the current court. So, and so now, you know, we have a vastly changed system. We continue to try to find ways in the state of Montana to fight back. We did pass what we called the Disclose Act, with a narrow bipartisan support, that sort of allows you to know at least who's giving the money. There's a famous Republican legislator out here in Montana named Dwayne Ankeny. He represents Coal Strip, Montana, which is where there's a big coal mine, and he sort of looks like Yosemite Sam, but he got up on the Senate side of things and he just explained it to that, you know, if somebody's going to shoot you in the gut, you know, you have a right to know who's shooting you. And that's sort of what some of this campaign finance money is, right? Is you don't know who it's coming from and mm-hmm. who's buying the ads. And that's what these super PACs are, right? Is just mysterious money to win elections, or what, as I like to say, to buy elections and to buy politicians. And so it's real, it's dangerous. And the reason that people should believe that it's the most important issue in American politics right now is because it will affect every other issue. Because if you want to continue to see the far right wing faces that we're seeing right now, this is a result of Alec and the Koch brothers. These are the types of legislators. They're not people thinking for themselves. You know, that's not looked fondly apart. I mean, that's quite frankly, you know, that's why apparently they don't like John McCain anymore. They don't, because he, you know, he was maybe thinking too much for himself and not enough with the Koch brothers. So, you know, understanding the campaign finance situation, as Elizabeth Warren has talked so much about as well, is so important in this country.
Right, and you're so right. And the way I talk about the problem of money in politics is it's the cancer underlying all other cancers. The influence of money is just distorting every area, whether you're talking about, you know, environmental protection, women's rights, you know, any issue, energy and moving to renewable energy, any issue you talk about is now being distorted because of the influence of big money on it. So I'm glad you're there. We just have about one more minute to before we need to wrap up. But before we go, I just want to ask you, you mentioned about the presidential race, about Hillary's in, Bernie Sanders is in, Biden may or may not be in, but are you backing anyone for president?
Well, you know, I don't know if I'd like to see if Joe Biden gets in or not before I make that call. You know, my politics are certainly probably aligned a little bit more with Bernie Sanders, but boy, I sure believe in Hillary Clinton, and I'd love to see a woman president. She clearly has earned every bit to be there, and I am so proud to see how, you know, that she's really a front runner. But like I said, you know, my politics is probably a little bit more with Bernie, but I sure would love to see what Joe Biden's going to do. And it's so interesting to me, these new ads that have come up, you know, who's paying for them. It's all very curious. But I will say that I saw the interview with Joe Biden on Stephen Colbert, and I teared up. And my husband, who isn't quite as fond of politics as I am, you know, he said that's a hell of a guy, and that's a genuine guy. And it'd be interesting if the American public reacts that way too. You know, I think people really find him to be an authentic human being. So we'll make it an interesting mix, and I am interested in what's going to happen.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a great race. We've got part of me wants to see a Bernie Sanders versus Donald Trump, but anyway, that's all the time we have. Representative Ellie Bowman Hill, thank you so much for coming on the program.
Thanks, Eleanor. It was my pleasure. It was an honor to talk to you.